So I want you to imagine a receptionist. Let's call him Carl.
Okay, Carl.
Yeah, Carl works at this massive brokerage firm, and he hates his job. Like, he really hates answering the phone, and he is deeply, deeply terrified of clients.
Sounds like a great fit for the financial industry.
Right. Total natural. So one Tuesday, his boss is in the bathroom. The phone rings on his boss's desk, and Carl just panics.
Hold on.
Yeah, he picks it up. And the client on the other end is literally screaming, just demanding to buy 500 shares of Apple right this exact second before the market closes.
Just a totally normal Tuesday.
Exactly. So Carl, sweating profusely, just wanting this guy to stop yelling at him, he types the order into the computer system and just hits execute.
Wow.
Okay. And in that, 5 second span, our terrified, totally well-meaning receptionist just committed a state-level regulatory crime.
A fairly serious one, too. I mean, he just stepped on an invisible tripwire that regulatory agencies absolutely take no prisoners over.
And today we are exploring those invisible
We
tripwires.
really are.
But before we get into how you can, accidentally commit a massive securities violation, I should mention that this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah. Surf fuel is great.
It really is. Because look, preparing for the Series 65 is an absolute grind. But Cert Fuel has this full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Yeah, the adaptive part is huge.
Right.
Yeah.
It actually learns what you are struggling with so you don't waste time on what you already know. You can check it out at certfuel.com. It's totally worth it.
It is a lifesaver because, I mean, the material we are covering today, the Uniform Securities Act's definition of an agent, is really the cornerstone of the entire regulatory framework.
The absolute foundation.
Right. If you don't fully grasp who an agent is, literally nothing else in the rulebook is going to make any sense at all.
Exactly. And look, I am speaking directly to you right now, the listener. You are prepping for the Series 65.
You're in the trenches.
You really are. And we know that studying securities law usually feels like, I don't know, trying to eat drywall.
It's just so dense.
It is dense, it is dry, and it is meticulously designed by lawyers to make your eyes glaze over. But you need this information to stick.
Like, really stick, not just recognize it on a flashcard.
Exactly. You need to recall these rules under intense, high-pressure exam conditions. So today, we are throwing out the textbook recitation. We're skipping the dry
Oh,
lectures.
nobody wants that.
No. We are going to make this stick using absurd hypotheticals, and we are going to build a little, cinematic universe of securities law using a recurring cast of characters.
I love this approach. I really do. Because knowing the rule is only half the battle.
Right.
The exam writers, they aren't going to just ask you to recite a definition from memory. They are going to give you this messy, real-world scenario and ask you to apply it.
They want to see if you actually get it.
Exactly. You have to understand the underlying logic, the actual why behind the rule.
So let's introduce the cast of our little universe right now. First up, we have Broker Bob.
Classic Bob.
Yeah, Bob is hungry. He is always hustling for commissions, always pitching the next hot stock, and frankly, he is constantly toeing the line of what is legally permissible.
We all know a Bob.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Next, we have founder Fiona. Fiona is a brilliant Ivy League tech CEO. She wears the sharp tailored suits. Her startup is just exploding, but she has this one defining trait.
What's that?
She absolutely despises paying Wall Street fees. She will look for any loophole to save a single dollar.
Okay, I can see where this is going.
And finally, we have our receptionist, Clerical Carl. Carl is terrified of human interaction. He just wants to file his paperwork, organize his color-coded highlighters, and be left entirely alone.
The Uniform Securities Act, which, we'll just call the USA to save time, it treats each of these three personalities in wildly different ways,
Right.
and it all really hinges on the biological and legal definition of an agent.
Okay, let's start right there. The biology of it all. Because before we figure out what an agent does,
Yeah.
we have to figure out what an agent even is on a physical level.
Yeah, the basic requirement.
Right. So let's say Broker Bob is having a phenomenal year. He's making so much money that his accountant tells him, "Hey, Bob, you need to incorporate to save on taxes."
Makes sense.
So Bob goes out and creates a shiny new limited liability company, an LLC. And he says, "From now on, Bob's LLC is the agent. Pay the LLC." Can he legally register a corporate entity as an agent? Or, let's get even weirder. Could he register his highly trained, incredibly smart golden retriever?
The answer to both the LLC and the dog is a definitive, legally binding no.
Not the dog.
Sorry to the dog. But the reason comes down to the very first defining element of agent status under the USA.
Which is?
My natural person requirement. An agent must be a human being, period. It requires a pulse, a birth certificate, and a consciousness.
Wait, but why? I mean, corporations have all sorts of rights in America. They can sign contracts and stuff. Why can't a corporation be an agent?
Think about the enforcement mechanism. The ultimate threat the state administrator has against an agent is putting them in handcuffs.
Oh, right.
Or barring them from the industry because they acted unethically. You cannot put an LLC in handcuffs.
That is a very good point.
Right. A corporation doesn't have a conscience. The law requires a specific, breathing human being to take ultimate personal responsibility for the trades being recommended and executed.
That makes perfect sense when you phrase it like that. So an LLC is completely out, a partnership is out, a corporation is out.
Correct. And the exam loves to test this specific distinction.
Oh, so?
Well, they will try to confuse you by asking if a broker-dealer firm itself is an agent. A broker-dealer is a firm, right? It's an entity.
Right, like Charles Schwab or whatever.
Exactly. The human beings who represent that firm, the individuals doing the actual talking, clicking, and selling on the ground, those specific humans are the agents.
Okay, got it. So we know an agent is a breathing human.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, a lot of breathing humans work at a brokerage firm. The janitor is a breathing human.
Very true.
What exactly is their role? What is the core definition we're looking at here?
Okay, so under the USA, an agent is defined as any individual who represents a broker-dealer or an issuer in effecting or attempting to effect purchases or sales of securities.
Okay, wait. I want to zero in on those words. Effecting or attempting to effect.
Yes, that's the crucial part.
Because this is where the exam writers set their first major trap. And I'm going to put you, the listener, on the spot right now.
Here we go.
Listen to this scenario, pause the audio if you need to, and just answer this in your head before we break it down. Ready?
Let's hear it.
Here's the scenario. Broker Bob is having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad month. He spends 12 straight hours cold calling people. He is dialing for dollars.
Just grinding
it out. He leaves 50 voicemails. He pitches a speculative penny stock to 20 different people who immediately laugh and hang up on him.
Brutal.
It is. He makes absolutely zero sales. The entire day is a total bust. Not a single trade clears. No money changes hands at all. Here's the question. Does Broker Bob still need to be registered as an agent for that day's work?
Think about it.
Take a second. Pause if you need to and lock in your answer.
Okay. If you said yes, you successfully avoided a massive exam trap.
A huge one.
The test writers will try so hard to lure you into thinking that registration is only required when a transaction actually occurs.
Like when a trade actually clears and money moves.
Right, when a confirmation statement is generated. But the rule explicitly says affecting or are attempting to affect.
Attempting. The solicitation itself is the crime if you aren't licensed.
Exactly. The government is regulating the attempt. The exact moment Bob picks up that phone and tries to pitch a security on behalf of his broker-dealer, he is acting as an agent.
Even if he sucks at it.
Even if he's completely incompetent and makes zero sales, the law does not care. The act of trying to sell is what requires the license.
Why are they so strict on the attempt?
Because the state wants to ensure that anyone who is even talking to the public about buying securities is properly vetted, tested, and monitored.
It's honestly like driving a car without a license.
Mm.
You can't just tell the cop, well, I didn't actually make it to the grocery store. I just drove around the block.
That is a perfect analogy.
You were still driving.
You were still behind the wheel.
So the attempt is everything. But let's look at Bob's employment contract for a second. Because brokerage firms are notoriously cheap.
Oh, they love cutting costs.
So let's say Bob's firm says, hey, Bob, you're doing great, but we don't want to pay your health insurance anymore. And we really don't want to pay our half of your payroll taxes.
Standard corporate move.
Right. So we are going to reclassify you as an independent contractor. You are going to get a 1099 tax form at the end of the year instead of a W-2.
Okay.
If Bob is an independent contractor operating his own little sole proprietorship, is he still an agent of that firm?
Yes. Absolutely. This is what I like to call the independence illusion.
The independence illusion. I like that.
Because the Uniform Securities Act does not care about IRS tax designations at all.
Not even a little bit.
Zero. W-2, 1099, independent contractor, statutory employee. It is completely irrelevant to the state administrator.
Okay, so what do they care about?
If Bob represents a broker dealer and he is out there affecting or attempting to affect securities transactions with the public, he is an agent of that broker deal.
So you basically can't contract your way out of securities law.
You really can't. And broker dealers have tried this for decades, you know, to limit their liability.
Like trying to say it wasn't their fault.
Right. They try to say, hey, Bob's an independent contractor. His rogue trades aren't our fault. He's his own boss.
And what does the state say to that?
The state administrator says, nice try. He is selling on your behalf. He is your agent, and you are 100% responsible for supervising him.
Okay, so we know a human doing the selling or even trying to do the selling, regardless of their tax status, is an agent.
Right.
But what if that human is the ultimate boss? Do these rules apply to the C-suite? Because this brings us back to founder Fiona.
Ah, Fiona, the tech CEO. This is a very different dynamic than Bob.
Definitely. So Fiona is the CEO and a director on the board of her tech startup. And her startup is an issuer, meaning they issue securities to raise capital to fund their growth.
Right. They're creating the stock.
Exactly. Fiona wears the designer suits. She makes all the macro strategic decisions. She hires the lead engineers.
She's running the show.
She is. So the exam question is this. Is Fiona an agent simply because she holds the title of an officer of an issuer?
No, she is not. And this introduces a really critical nuance called the partner, officer, or director rule.
The POD rule.
Right. The state regulators recognize that running a company and selling stock are two entirely different jobs.
Okay.
Just having a prestigious title on your office door does not automatically suck you into the definition of an agent.
So if Fiona is just doing standard CEO things, you know, reviewing the budget, approving marketing campaigns, managing the engineering team, she is completely exempt.
She is not an agent. She is just fulfilling her administrative duties as a corporate officer.
But as we established earlier, Fiona hates paying Wall Street.
She hates the fees.
She hates them. So let's say her startup needs an injection of $10 million to scale up. She looks at the investment bankers who want to charge her a 7% underwriting fee to sell her new public stock offering.
Which is a huge chunk of money.
It is. Fiona does the math and says, 7% of $10 million is $700,000. Forget that. I'm charming. I know this business better than any banker. I'll just sell the stock myself.
Uh-oh.
Right. So she skips the broker-dealer entirely. She picks up her phone and starts personally calling wealthy investors, pitching her company's non-exempt public stock offering.
And that is the exact moment the switch flips.
Boom.
The very moment she starts soliciting investors, pitching the stock, and trying to secure capital, she crosses the regulatory line.
Even though she's the CEO.
Doesn't matter. She ceases to be just an executive and becomes an individual representing an issuer attempting to affect a securities transaction.
Wow.
She is now an agent, and she must be registered as such.
I want to flag this for you, the listener, right now. Because the exam writers are going to try to blind you with prestige.
Oh, they love doing this.
They really do. They will write a question that says something like, Margaret is the senior executive vice president, managing partner, and chief operations officer of XYZ Corporation. She spends her days executing strategic vision.
Sounds very fancy.
Very fancy. And then they will ask, is Margaret an agent?
The takeaway here is that actions dictate status, not titles.
I'm going to repeat that. Actions dictate status.
Always ignore the business card. Look purely at the verb in the sentence. What is the person actually doing in this scenario?
Right. Are they managing or are they selling?
Exactly. If they are sitting in board meetings and reviewing spreadsheets, no registration. If they are actively pitching and selling stock to the public, they are an agent.
Okay. So actions dictate status. But if that is the case, are there any actions that let you off the hook? Let's talk about the escape hatches.
The exclusions from the agent definition.
Right. And I want to do a quick pattern interrupt here. Shake out your arms, take a deep breath, because this is where the exam writers get incredibly sneaky.
This is a high danger zone on the test.
It is. To make this digestible, we have to compartmentalize. I want you to imagine two physical buckets in your mind right now.
Okay. Two buckets.
Bucket one is for broker dealers. Bucket two is for issuers. The rules for who gets excluded depend entirely on which bucket you are standing in.
That's a great way to visualize it.
So let's look at bucket one first, the broker-dealer exclusion. To explore this, we need to check back in with Clerical Carl.
Our terrified receptionist.
Yes. Carl works for Broker Bob's firm. He's got his highlighters. He's got his stapler. Does Carl have to register as an agent just because he is employed by a broker-dealer?
No. Carl falls under what is known as the clerical and ministerial function exclusion.
Clerical and ministerial.
Right. It stems from the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The law recognizes that a brokerage firm needs administrative support just to function.
Like, someone has to answer the phones.
Exactly. As long as Carl is strictly performing ministerial duties, you know, answering the phones, directing calls to the licensed brokers, filing paperwork, updating mailing addresses, he is entirely excluded from the definition of an agent.
Because he is not affecting or attempting to affect trades.
Right.
But let's go back to my hook from the very beginning of this deep dive. Bob is in the bathroom.
Right.
The phone rings on Bob's desk. Carl, despite his extreme anxiety, picks it up. The client screams, "I need to buy 500 shares of Apple right now."
And Carl panics.
Carl types the order into Bob's terminal and hits execute. So we teased this earlier, but let's really break down the mechanics of why it's illegal.
Carl just engaged in unregistered agent activity.
Is it because he actually pressed the button, like the physical act of typing it in?
No, it's because he accepted the order.
Oh, wow. Just accepting it.
Yes. The moment you take an order from a client, even if you don't offer any advice, even if you are literally just acting as a human keyboard, you are effecting a securities transaction.
So he stepped outside bucket one.
He stepped outside his clerical exclusion. The only thing Carl is legally allowed to say in that high-pressure situation is, "I'm sorry, Bob is unavailable. Would you like his voicemail?"
That's it.
That's it. If Carl touches that order ticket, he's acting as an agent without a license.
So the line for bucket one, the broker-dealer bucket, is brutally strict. No taking orders, no pitching, no discussing the merits of a stock.
Purely clerical, or you need a license.
Wow. Okay, so that's bucket one. But when we move over to bucket two, the issuer exclusions, things change, right?
They do. The state regulators give a lot more leeway when you are dealing with issuers.
Why is that?
Well, remember, these exclusions apply primarily to individuals representing issuers like founder Fiona, who are just trying to raise money for their own specific companies.
Right. They aren't broker dealers selling everything under the sun.
Exactly. They aren't in the business of trading. They are in the business of whatever their company does.
Okay, so let's explore Fiona's loopholes. What are the ways Fiona can represent her company, actively sell securities, and still avoid having to register as an agent?
There are three main categories of exclusions for individuals representing an issuer. First up, we have exempt securities.
Exempt securities. What does that mean?
If Fiona represents her issuer in transactions involving securities that the USA treats as inherently safe, or that are already heavily regulated by another body, she is excluded.
Give me a real-world example of an exempt security, something concrete.
The most common ones on the exam would be U.S. government securities, municipal bonds, or securities issued by a bank.
Okay, let's play this out. So if Fiona was hypothetically, I don't know, the mayor of Chicago.
Mayor Fiona.
And she was personally pitching the city's new municipal bonds to investors to fund a new bridge.
Right.
She wouldn't need to take the Series 65 and register as an agent just to sell those bridge bonds.
Precisely. The state administrator assumes municipal bonds are safe enough that we don't need to force the mayor to go get a securities license just to do her job.
That makes sense. Okay, so that's category one. What's the second category?
The second category is exempt transactions.
Exempt transactions. How is that different?
These are specific types of trades that, by their very nature, don't require the protection of an agent registration.
How so? Like, who doesn't need protection from the state?
Institutions. A prime example of an exempt transaction is a transaction executed exclusively with institutional investors.
Oh, okay.
So if Fiona is flying to New York and she is only pitching her startup stock to massive hedge funds, mutual funds, or commercial banks, she does not need to register.
Because the hedge fund has an army of lawyers and analysts.
Exactly. The core philosophy of the Uniform Securities Act is protecting retail investors, you know, everyday moms and pops.
Right.
The law assumes that a multi-billion dollar hedge fund can fend for itself. They don't need the state administrator to ensure Fiona has a license before she pitches them.
They know what they're doing. Okay, so that's exempt securities and exempt transactions. What's the third one?
Federal covered securities.
Federal covered. Translation, please. What makes a security federal covered?
It generally means the security is regulated at the federal level by the SEC, so the states basically back off.
They let the feds handle it.
Right. Examples would be a stock that's already listed on a major exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange, or a private placement offering under Regulation D.
Got it.
If she is dealing strictly in those, state agent registration is typically bypassed.
Okay, so she actually has a lot of maneuvering room as an issuer. But there is one more issuer exclusion, and I want to spend a lot of time on this.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
Because it contains the single most dangerous trap on the entire exam. Let's set up this scenario for the listener.
Let's do it.
Fiona's startup is doing really well, and she wants to retain her top engineering talent. She decides to set up an employee stock purchase plan.
Very common.
Right. She is going to sell company stock directly to her existing employees, partners, and directors.
A standard corporate retention strategy.
Exactly. And Fiona, being Fiona, does all the pitching herself to save money. She rents out the company cafeteria, holds this massive town hall meeting, hypes up the company's future, and just aggressively encourages her employees to buy into the stock plan.
Really hyping it up.
Oh, yeah. She tells them, this is your chance to get rich with me. Now, Fiona does not charge any upfront commission on these sales.
Okay, no commission.
No commission. However, behind the scenes, the board of directors loves her initiative. At the end of the year, the board gives Fiona a special $50,000 performance bonus that is mathematically tied to the volume of employees who bought into the stock plan.
I see exactly the trap you're setting here.
Let's ask the listener. Think about this carefully. Pause if you need to. Based on the rules of issuer exclusions, is Fiona excluded from being an agent in this scenario?
Think about the bonus.
She sold to employees. She didn't charge a commission, but she got a year-end bonus based on those sales. Do you have your answer?
If you said she is excluded, you just fell into the no commission exam trap.
It's a brutal one.
The answer is an aggressive NO. She's an agent, and she just committed a massive violation.
Walk us through exactly why. Unpack that for us.
So there is an exclusion for an individual representing an issuer in transactions with existing employees, partners, or directors.
Right. That part is true.
It is true. But that exclusion has an incredibly strict fatal condition attached to it.
Which is?
No commission or other remuneration can be paid or given directly or indirectly for soliciting any person in the state.
Directly or indirectly. That is the phrase that pays right there.
Yes. The exam will try to disguise the commission to make it look innocent.
Right. They won't call it a commission.
Exactly. They will call it a year-end bonus, a quota reward, a perk, maybe an all-expenses-paid vacation. But the state regulators are not stupid.
They follow the money.
They follow the money. If an auditor comes in and sees that Fiona's $50,000 bonus was triggered by her soliciting employees to buy stock, that is indirect remuneration.
Because she was financially incentivized to make that pitch in the cafeteria.
Exactly. The moment she receives any financial incentive tied to that solicitation, she loses the exclusion entirely.
Wow.
She reverts to being an agent. And because she wasn't registered when she gave that speech, she just executed illegal unregistered sales.
What if she hadn't taken the bonus?
If she had just held the town hall, sold the stock to her employees, and received her standard salary without a single dime of extra compensation for the effort,
right,
she would be perfectly excluded.
But the bonus ruins it.
The bonus ruins it completely.
Okay, so we figured out that Bob is definitely an agent, and Fiona, because of her sneaky bonus, got caught and is also an agent. They can't escape it.
They are on the hook.
So how do they actually get legal? Let's talk about the paperwork labyrinth.
Yeah.
And more importantly, the specific timelines the exam absolutely loves to test.
If you are going to be an agent in the securities industry, your entire professional life will revolve around two things. Form U4 and the CRD.
Let's define those really quick. Form U4 is the Uniform Application for Securities Industry Registration or Transfer.
It's basically your golden ticket application.
Right. And the CRD is the Central Registration Depository.
Yeah.
Honestly, I have always imagined the CRD as this massive, heavily guarded, windowless server farm out in a desert somewhere that just holds the darkest, most embarrassing secrets of every stockbroker in America.
I mean, it's honestly not far off from that.
Really?
Yeah. The CRD is a massive electronic database managed by FINAR that facilitates registration across all states. Mm-hmm. And Form U4 is the physical, well, electronic document you submit to get your name into that system.
Got it.
But you were totally right to bring up secrets because the disclosures required on Form U4 are remarkably invasive.
They want to know everything.
Everything. Regulators want to know exactly who they are letting into the financial system. They want your 10-year employment history. They want your 5-year residential history. But most importantly, they want your criminal skeletons in the closet.
Okay, I want to push back on this a little bit because it feels incredibly intrusive, almost unfair.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's pretend I'm an applicant. I'm 40 years old now. I have a master's degree, a perfectly clean record, a family, a mortgage.
An upstanding citizen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when I was 18 years old, I was a dumb college kid, and I got arrested for shoplifting a $20 video game from a department store.
Okay.
I got a misdemeanor charge. I paid a fine, did some community service, and moved on. That was 22 years ago.
Okay.
Do I really have to disclose a teenage mistake on my U4 to become a stockbroker today?
Yes. You absolutely, unequivocally must disclose it.
Seriously?
Yes. And this is a very common point of confusion for applicants in the real world, and it's a favorite topic for exam writers. The rule is absolute. All criminal history, both charges and convictions, must be disclosed on the U4.
Regardless of how long ago it happened.
Right.
Wait, there is no statute of limitations on disclosure.
None. Zero. The regulators don't care if it happened during the Clinton administration.
Oh, wow.
Even if it was 22 years ago, and listen to this, even if it was just a charge and you weren't ultimately convicted, you must check yes on the U4 and provide a written explanation.
Why? I mean, that seems overly punitive for a minor offense decades ago.
Because the U4 is fundamentally a test of your present-day honesty.
Oh, I see.
The administrator might look at a 22-year-old shoplifting charge and say, whatever, he was a dumb kid, we will approve the license.
Right.
But if you hide that charge, and the FBI fingerprint check pulls it up.
Which it will.
You are now guilty of lying to a regulatory body on a formal application. And lying on the U4 is infinitely worse than the original crime.
It's the cover-up.
Exactly. If you lie, they will bar you from the industry for life because you cannot be trusted with client money.
That makes a lot of sense. The cover-up is worse than the crime. Okay, so full transparency is required. Always.
Oh.
Now, let's say I fill out the U4 properly. I disclose the video game heist, and I get registered. I'm working as an agent. But, you know, life happens. Things change.
You always do.
I move to a new apartment. Or maybe a client gets mad and hits me with a civil lawsuit. Or, worst case scenario, I get into a bar fight and get charged with a felony assault.
A bad weekend.
A very bad weekend. I know I have to update my U4 to reflect these changes, but the exam loves testing deadlines. Give me the breakdown on update deadlines.
Okay. The exam writers want to see if you understand the triage of regulatory risk.
Triage meaning sorting by severity.
Right. They divide events into two distinct categories. Standard life events and major red flags.
Okay.
For normal, everyday reportable events. Let's say you change your home address, a customer files a written complaint against you, you are named in a standard civil action, or you start an outside business activity.
Like driving for Uber or something.
Sure. For all of those, you have 30 days to amend your U4.
30 days for the standard administrative stuff.
Right. But if you experience what is called a statutory disqualification event, the timeline shrinks drastically.
What's a statutory disqualification event?
If you are criminally charged with a felony, or if you are suspended or barred by another regulatory body like the SEC or FINRA, for those, you have exactly 10 business days to amend your U4.
10 business days. That is incredibly fast. Why the huge discrepancy? Why 30 days for an address, but only 10 days for a felony?
It goes right back to protecting the retail investor. If you move to a new apartment, client money is not at risk. The state can wait 30 days to update their mailing list.
Sure.
But if you are suddenly charged with felony embezzlement or fraud, there is a very real chance that your current client's life savings are in immediate severe danger.
Oh, that makes sense.
The administrator needs to know instantly so they can step in, potentially freeze accounts, and suspend your license before more harm is done. It is a literal emergency alarm.
That clarifies it perfectly. The timeline matches the threat level.
Mm.
Okay, let's rewind a second to the initial application process.
Yep.
I fill out my U4. I hit submit on the CRD portal at 9:00 a.m. on a Tuesday. I pass my exam. Can I start cold calling and executing trades that afternoon?
No. Hitting submit does not make you an agent.
It doesn't.
Not at all. You are entering what we can call the 30-day waiting room.
The 30-day waiting room.
Under the Uniform Securities Act, if there is no denial order in effect and no proceeding is pending against you, your registration automatically becomes effective on the 30th day at noon after your application is filed.
The 30th day at noon. That is a wonderfully specific, totally arbitrary sounding time.
It is very specific.
But I smell an exam trap here.
Yeah.
Let me ask the listener, is it always exactly 30 days? Think about it.
No, it is not. And that is exactly the trap.
Uh-huh.
The 30-day mark is a default maximum waiting period, not a strict minimum. The state administrator, who, remember, is the head official in charge of enforcing these rules, has the discretionary power to accelerate this timeline.
So they can speed it up if they want to.
Yes. If they look at your application, see that you have a spotless record, great credit, and solid training, the administrator can say, looks good. You don't need to wait a month. You are effective today on day 5.
That's nice of them. And conversely, can they slow it down?
Absolutely. If they see that shoplifting charge from 20 years ago and decide they want to pull the police report to make sure it wasn't actually armed robbery, they can initiate a proceeding to deny or review the application.
And what happens to the clock then?
The exact moment they initiate that proceeding, the 30-day clock stops dead. Your registration is delayed indefinitely until the proceeding is legally resolved.
Okay, so the administrator absolutely holds the keys to the waiting room. Now, let's say the 30 days pass, or they speed it up, and I am officially registered.
Congrats.
Thank you. Who do I belong to?
Yeah.
We touched on this with Bob's LLC idea earlier, but I want to dive deeper into the mechanics of employment.
You belong to your firm.
I belong to my firm.
Agent registration is entirely employer specific. This is what the industry calls the employer tether.
The employer tether.
You, as a human being, are useless without a registered firm backing you. Your registration is literally not effective during any period when you are not actively associated with a particular registered broker dealer or issuer.
So if Broker Bob gets fed up, yells, "I quit," and storms out of firm A on a Friday afternoon.
A dramatic exit.
Very dramatic. He is no longer an active agent on Saturday morning, even though he passed his Series 65 and has a totally clean record.
Correct. On Saturday morning, his license is essentially dormant.
Wait, really? So if he logs into his laptop from home on Saturday and tries to execute a trade just for his cousin, what happens?
He is committing a violation. He cannot legally affect trades until he is officially tethered to a new firm.
Which brings us to a highly testable, very common real-world scenario. Let's talk about the triangle of notification.
Oh, they test this heavily.
So here's the scenario. Broker Bob is a top producer. He is bringing in millions. He decides he hates his manager at firm A, and he accepts a massive signing bonus to move his entire book of business across the street to firm B.
A classic Wall Street maneuver. Happens all the time.
Right. So Bob leaves firm A and goes to firm B. Here is my question for the listener. Pause and think this through. When Bob makes this move, who holds the legal responsibility to tell the state administrator about the transfer?
Think about all the parties involved.
Is it Bob? Is it firm A? Or is it firm B? Lock in your guess.
The answer is all three of them.
All three.
All three. Bob must notify the administrator that he moved. Firm A, the old employer, must notify the administrator that he left. And firm B, the new employer, must notify the administrator that they hired him. And they must all do it promptly.
A three-way notification requirement. Why force all three parties to do paperwork for one guy moving across the street?
Because the administrator demands absolute continuity of jurisdiction.
They want to know exactly where he is.
Exactly where every agent is at all times. And by forcing all three to report it, they create a fail-safe.
A fail-safe against what?
Well, imagine if Bob tries to hide the fact that he was actually fired from firm A for stealing instead of leaving voluntarily.
Oh, I see.
Firm A's mandatory notification will alert the state to the truth, even if Bob lies to firm B.
Triangulation. That's smart. Speaking of tracking time, let's do a quick rapid-fire fact. When does my agent registration expire?
Okay, hit me.
If I finally get through the waiting room and get registered on November 15th, do I get a full year until next November?
No. All registrations under the USA expire on December 31st of the current year, no matter when you originally registered.
Wait, seriously. So if I get registered on December 30th, I only get one single day of being an agent before I have to renew.
Unfortunately, yes. At midnight on New Year's Eve, your registration expires unless your firm has paid the renewal fees and processed the renewal through the CRD system.
That seems so annoying.
It is, but it simplifies the administrative burden for the state. They just process all renewals at once at the end of the year.
It's literally like Cinderella, but instead of a carriage turning into a pumpkin, your entire career turns into a regulatory violation at midnight.
Exactly. Don't be caught trading at 12:01 a.m. without a renewal.
Okay, let's pivot to the darker side of this industry. What happens when the relationship ends poorly? Whether you quit gracefully or you are dragged out of the building by security, the paper trail does not stop.
It definitely doesn't.
Let's say Broker Bob finally pushes it too far. He is aggressively selling highly unsuitable, super risky tech stocks to elderly retirees.
Terrible.
Just awful. His compliance department catches it, they panic, and Firm A fires him on the spot.
The exact moment Bob has walked out the door, Firm A has a strict legal obligation to file Form U-5.
Form U-5, the Uniform Termination Notice. Who files this? Does Bob have to confess, or does the firm do it?
Only the employer. Form U-5 is filed by the broker, dealer, or issuer, not the agent. And they have a straight deadline, exactly 30 days from Bob's end date, to file it via the CRD.
Now, Bio's a big producer, right? Firm A doesn't want a huge scandal in the press. Can they just check a generic box in the U5 that says Bob no longer works here, wish him well, and leave it at that?
Absolutely not. They must state the specific reason for termination.
They have to spell it out.
They do. The CRD requires them to categorize the departure. Was it a voluntary resignation? Was he terminated for cause? Was he permitted to resign because he was under investigation and about to be fired anyway?
Or was it just like laid off?
Right. Or if he was fired for cause, Firm A is legally required to detail exactly what Bob did wrong in the filing.
Why are they forced to air his dirty laundry? Isn't that bad for the firm too?
It is, but it's to prevent a phenomenon known as passing the trash.
Passing the trash? What is that?
In the 80s and 90s, before electronic records were robust, a broker could commit fraud at Firm A, get quietly fired to avoid bad PR, and just walk across the street to get hired by Firm B.
Where he would immediately start stealing from new clients.
Exactly. The mandatory U5 disclosure ensures that Bob's bad behavior is permanently etched into his public record, warning any future employers and the state regulators.
So Bob's career is severely damaged. Now, Bob is unemployed. He's sitting on his couch watching daytime television, feeling sorry for himself.
Eating potato chips.
He isn't tethered to a firm. What happens to his state licenses like his series 63, 65, or 66 exams that he studied so hard for while he is sitting there on the couch?
A very specific clock starts ticking. This is the 2-year license lapse rule.
2-year license lapse.
If Brad is not registered with a new firm within exactly 2 years from his termination date, his state-administered licenses turn to dust. They lapse completely.
So he waits 2 years and 1 day to get a new job.
He is out of luck. He has to sit down in a testing center and pass those brutal exams all over again.
Wow. Why 2 years?
The logic here is that the financial industry changes rapidly. New regulations, new products, new tax laws. If you are out of the game for more than 2 years, the state assumes your knowledge is dangerously obsolete and you must prove your competence again.
That is a terrifying motivator to get back to work. I would not want to take the 65 twice.
Nobody does.
Now, here is a scenario I really want to dig into because it highlights one of the most confusing, highly tested areas of the Series 65.
Let's do it.
The post-withdrawal enforcement windows.
Oh, pay attention here.
Let's say Bob realizes the walls are closing in. He knows the state administrator is investigating him for those shady tech stock trades. He knows they are building a case against him.
He sees the writing on the wall.
Exactly. So Bob decides to beat them to the punch. He formally submits a withdrawal of his registration. He sells his house, moves to a cabin in the woods completely off the grid, and says, I quit. I'm not an agent anymore. I'm a lumberjack. You can't touch me.
A lumberjack.
Yes. Is he safe? Does quitting protect him?
Not even close. The administrator's authority does not just evaporate because you surrender your license and run into the woods.
So they can still get him.
Oh, yeah. We have to look at two entirely separate, highly testable enforcement windows here. The 1-year administrative window and the 5-year criminal window.
Okay, let's take those one at a time. What is the 1-year administrative window?
The administrator retains administrative jurisdiction over Bob for 1 year after his withdrawal becomes effective.
Ring what?
This means for up to 365 days after Bob officially leaves the industry, the administrator can still institute revocation or suspension proceedings against his now withdrawn license.
Wait. If he already withdrew his license and he's living in a cabin, why does the administrator waste taxpayer money trying to revoke a license that doesn't even exist anymore? It feels like firing someone who already quit.
Yeah.
What is the actual point?
The point is the permanent record.
Ah.
If Bob just withdraws voluntarily, his CRD record looks relatively clean. It just looks like he retired or changed careers. But the administrator wants a formal revocation on his record.
Because it acts as a black mark.
A revocation acts as a regulatory bar. It effectively blacklists him from the financial industry nationwide. If he ever tries to come back from the woods in 5 years and apply in a different state, that revocation will pop up and block him. They do it to permanently stain his record and protect the public.
Ah, so they salting the earth so he can never come back. And this 1-year window applies to any rule violations.
Yes, any violation of the USA committed while he was registered, whether it was a minor non-criminal rule break, a failure to supervise, or a major fraud.
Okay, so that's the 1-year window for the administrator to ruin his resume. What is the 5-year criminal window?
This is an entirely different level of severity. If Bob's shady trades didn't just break a technical rule, but involved actual criminal fraud-like stealing client money, forgery, or blatant embezzlement, The state doesn't just want to revoke his license.
They want to put him away.
They want to put him in prison. The administrator will investigate, gather the evidence, and then refer the case to the state attorney general for criminal prosecution.
Attorney general.
Right. Under the Uniform Securities Act, the statute of limitations for the state to bring criminal charges is typically 5 years from the date of the violation.
Okay, stop right there. I see a massive exam trap.
It's a big one.
The exam's going to ask this exact question. What is the time limit for the administrator to bring criminal charges against an agent? Why is that question a trick?
Because it blends two completely different authorities. The administrator is a regulatory official. They wear a suit. They sit behind a desk. They issue fines. They deal with red tape.
Right.
They do not have the power to bring criminal charges. Only the state attorney general, the actual law enforcement arm of the state, can prosecute criminal violations.
The administrator has the red tape. The attorney general has the handcuffs.
Exactly.
Let's emphasize the penalties to make sure that distinction is crystal clear for the listener. What happens if the administrator finds you guilty of a rule violation versus the attorney general finding you guilty of a crime?
Okay, so if the administrator takes action, the absolute worst they can do is revoke your license and issue civil fines. But under the USA, a criminal conviction prosecuted by the attorney general can carry a fine of up to $5,000 and up to 3 years in state prison.
Crucial distinction. The administrator cannot put you in a jail cell. Only a criminal court judge can sentence you to 3 years. So to summarize this for the listener's notes, 1 year for the administrator to take administrative action after you withdraw, 5 years for the attorney general to throw you in jail for a crime.
That is the exact breakdown you need for the exam. Memorize that.
Awesome. Now let's change gears entirely. Shake it out. We've spent all this time dissecting the DNA of an agent, but there is an evil twin on the exam.
An evil twin.
The investment advisor representative, or IRR.
Okay, I wouldn't call them an evil twin. They serve a vital purpose, but they are definitively distinct in the eyes of the law.
Well, on the exam, they act like evil twins because they look incredibly similar. They work in the exact same offices, but they operate under totally different legal frameworks. You have to be able to tell them apart in a lineup, or you will fail the test.
That is very true.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison. Let's look at the agent versus the IRR. And I'm going to use a medical analogy here to help it stick.
Okay, let's hear the analogy.
Think of the agent like a pharmacist. Think of the IRR like a doctor.
Okay, I like that.
Round one. Who do they represent?
The agent represents a broker-dealer or an issuer. The IRR represents an investment advisor firm.
Round two.
Yeah.
What is their primary day-to-day activity? Like, what is their actual job?
The agent affects securities transactions. They buy and sell. They execute the trades. The IRR provides investment advice. They build financial plans and recommend asset allocations.
So going back to the analogy, the pharmacist, the agent, physically dispenses the pills. The doctor, the IRR, diagnoses the patient and writes the prescription.
Spot on.
Round three, how do they get paid? Because this is usually the determining factor.
It almost always is. The agent is paid primarily through commissions or markups on the specific trades they execute. They get paid per transaction.
Okay, and the IRR?
The IRR is paid through advisory fees, which are typically an ongoing flat fee or a percentage of the client's assets under management, or AUM.
So the pharmacist gets paid when you buy the physical pills. The doctor gets paid a flat fee for the consultation, regardless of whether you actually buy the medicine or not.
Exactly.
Round four, the big one. The standard of care. When they sit across from a client and recommend something, what legal standard are they held to?
This is monumental. The agent is traditionally held to the standard of suitability. And now, under newer federal rules, Regulation Best Interest, or Reg BI.
What does that actually mean in practice?
This means they must ensure the trade is suitable for the client at the exact time of the transaction based on their risk profile.
Okay. And the IRR?
The IRR, however, is held to a strict fiduciary duty. This is a much higher, much more rigorous legal bar. The IRR must put the client's interests above their own at all times, disclose all conflicts of interest, and typically provide ongoing continuous monitoring of the account.
So the doctor has a fiduciary duty to heal you and look out for your overall health. The pharmacist just has to make sure the pills they hand you won't immediately interact with your other medications and kill you.
That's a bit grim, but yes, essentially correct.
Okay, so they are fundamentally different roles. But wait, Broker Bob is notoriously greedy. He likes getting paid commissions for trading, but he also looks at IIRs, collecting those steady recurring AUM fees every single quarter, and he wants a piece of that action.
Naturally.
Can Broker Bob be both a pharmacist and a doctor?
Yes, he absolutely can. Dual registration is extremely common in the modern financial industry.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You will often see an individual who is registered as an agent with a broker-dealer to execute trades, AD registered as an IIR with a separate affiliated investment advisor firm to charge financial planning fees.
But he has to pass different exams and file different paperwork, right?
Correct. There are two entirely distinct hats. Hmm. He files two separate applications on Form U-4, and he must maintain both licenses independently.
And I imagine he has to tell the client which hat he is wearing.
He absolutely has to clearly disclose to the client which hat he is wearing at any given time. He can't double dip without disclosure.
Now, here comes another massive exam trap regarding the line between these two roles. It's called the solely incidental rule.
This is a tricky one.
Let's say Bob is acting strictly as an agent, just the pharmacist. He is pitching a mutual fund. And in the course of that sales pitch, he looks at the client's portfolio and says, based on your age, I think this mutual fund fits really well into your long-term retirement plan.
Okay.
Technically, Bob just gave financial advice. Does giving that one piece of advice immediately force him to go register as an IRR?
No. The law provides a very specific carve-out for this exact reality. The regulators know that you can't sell a complex financial product without offering some level of incidental advice.
You'd be impossible to sell anything.
Right. The rule states that if a broker-dealer, and by extension, its registered agents, provides advice that is solely incidental to the conduct of their brokerage business, and they receive no special compensation for that advice, they are excluded from the definition of an investment advisor.
Solely incidental and no special compensation. Let's break those down so it's super clear.
So incidental means the advice just comes along for the ride with the trade execution. It isn't a separate, distinct service.
Okay.
And no special compensation means they aren't charging a separate fee just for the thinking part. Bob is getting paid his standard commission for selling the mutual fund. The advice was just part of the sales process.
So when does Bob cross the line? When does the state step in and say, nope, you are acting as an IIR now, show me your license?
The exact minute Bob says, I'll execute your trades for my standard commission, but before we do that, I'm going to charge you a $500 flat fee to build a comprehensive financial plan.
Boom. Special compensation.
Exactly. He is now being compensated specifically for the advice, not the execution. The solely incidental exclusion evaporates instantly, and he must be registered as an IRR.
It always comes back to the money.
Always. Follow how the person is getting paid, and you will know what license they need.
We are in the home stretch here. We've talked about how the administrator tracks you with the CRD. We've talked about how they categorize you as an agent or an IRR. Now let's look at how they can absolutely shut your career down.
The enforcement powers.
Yeah. What gives the administrator the legal authority to deny an applicant or suspend an active agent's license?
The USA outlines a long list of statutory grounds for denial, suspension, or revocation. If you file an application that contains a materially false statement like lying about that shoplifting charge, they can deny you.
Right, the lying we talked about.
If a court enjoins you from engaging in the securities business, they can deny you. If you are found to be insolvent and literally can't pay your own bills, they can deny you because someone who is bankrupt might be tempted to steal client funds.
Makes sense. Desperate people do desperate things.
But the biggest one, the one that tests most frequently, is the 10-year rule regarding criminal convictions.
Let's unpack the 10-year rule. What exactly does it say?
The administrator may deny your registration if you have been convicted of ANI felony or a securities-related misdemeanor within the past 10 years.
Okay, let's parse that carefully. You said ANI felony. Let's say I got into a horrible property dispute 5 years ago and committed felony arson. I burned down a barn.
A barn, okay.
That has absolutely nothing to do with finance, money, or Wall Street. Can the administrator deny my Series 65 application because of felony arson?
Absolutely. The regulators take a very broad view of character. A felony conviction of any kind shows a fundamental, severe disregard for the law and societal rules.
They just don't trust you.
The administrator does not want people with a history of severe legal recklessness handling the life savings of retail investors.
Okay, so any felony is a massive red flag. What about misdemeanors?
The standard changes for misdemeanors. Only securities-related misdemeanors trigger the automatic statutory disqualification.
So if I have a misdemeanor for, like, a noise complaint at a college frat party or a minor traffic violation, that won't automatically disqualify me.
Correct. You still have to disclose it on the U-4 if it's a criminal misdemeanor charge, but it is not a statutory ground for automatic denial. The administrator will look at a noise complaint and basically ignore it.
But what if it's not a noise complaint?
If you have a misdemeanor for embezzlement, forgery, extortion, or defrauding a business, even if it was a very small amount of money, yes, that is a securities-related crime involving dishonesty. That gives the administrator the power to deny you immediately.
Okay, here's a highly specific, nuanced question. Let's go back to the felony, the barn burning.
Right, the arson.
What if my felony conviction was 11 years ago? I served my time, I reformed my life, and it has been over a decade. What happens then?
This is a beautiful intersection of two different rules we've discussed today. This brings us back to the U-4 disclosure rules versus the administrator's denial powers.
Oh, this is going to be good.
You still have to disclose the 11-year-old felony on your form U-4. Remember, criminal history disclosures on the application have no time limit. You must tell them about it.
Right, the permanent record.
However, because the conviction occurred more than 10 years ago, it falls outside the 10-year rule window. It is no longer an automatic statutory disqualification.
Oh.
The administrator will read your disclosure, but they cannot use that specific 11-year-old conviction as the sole statutory ground to automatically deny your license under that provision.
Fascinating. So you still have to confess your sins, but the administrator loses their automatic veto power if the sin is old enough.
Exactly. I mean, they could still try to deny you under a different provision, perhaps citing a broader lack of good character, but they can't use the automatic 10-year statutory disqualification rule.
Now, let's look at a completely different reason for denial. This is for the listener. Pause the audio and think about clerical Carl.
Carl wants to move up in the world.
He does. Carl finally decides he wants to overcome his fear of human interaction. He wants to make the big bucks. He studies incredibly hard. He passes his Series 65 on the first try, and he applies to become an agent.
Good for Carl.
However, Carl has literally 0 days of sales experience. He has never sold a single thing in his life. He has only ever filed paperwork and used highlighters.
True.
Can the administrator deny Carl's application simply because he has a complete lack of experience?
Yeah.
Answer it in your head.
The answer is NO. And this is a very common exam trap.
Why not? Should we want experienced people handling our money?
Yes, but the statute explicitly states that the administrator cannot deny registration solely on the basis of a lack of experience.
Or solely on that basis.
Right. The standard the administrator is required to evaluate is a three-pronged test: training, experience, and knowledge. It is a holistic review.
So Carl's knowledge saves him.
Exactly. If Carl lacks experience, but he proves his knowledge by passing the rigorous Series 65 exam, and his broker-dealer vouches that they will provide him with excellent internal training and supervision, that offsets the lack of experience.
The law recognizes that every single professional has a first day on the job.
We all have to start somewhere. You cannot be denied just for being new.
That is actually oddly comforting. Now let's look at emergency powers. Let's say Broker Bob is out there actively registered, and the administrator gets a highly credible tip from Insider that Bob is currently actively stealing client funds and wiring them to an offshore account.
A true emergency.
Right. The administrator doesn't have time to schedule a formal court date for next month. They need to stop him today before the money disappears. What power do they have?
The administrator can issue a summary suspension. A summary order allows the administrator to suspend Bob's registration immediately without a prior hearing, to protect the public interest.
Wait, without a hearing? Doesn't that violate his constitutional right to due process? You can't just take away someone's livelihood without letting them defend themselves.
Due process is preserved, but it happens after the fact in emergency situations. The administrator acts first to stop the bleeding.
Okay, so what happens next?
To satisfy due process, the administrator must promptly notify Bob in writing of the suspension and the specific reasons for it. Furthermore, they must grant him a hearing within 15 days if Bob requests one in writing.
So they freeze his license today to protect the clients, but he gets his day in court within 2 weeks to prove his innocence.
Act first, ask questions within 15 days.
They also have the power to issue a cease and desist order, right?
Yes. If Bob isn't registered but is acting like an agent, they can't suspend a license he doesn't have. So instead, they issue a cease and desist order, legally compelling him to immediately halt his illegal activities.
Okay, I have one final attempt to find a loophole in the Uniform Securities Act. I love trying to break this system.
Let's see if you can.
Let's go back to founder Fiona. Let's say Fiona is incredibly careful this time. She figures out a way to sell her startup stock perfectly within an exclusion. She only sells to massive institutional investors. She doesn't take a bonus. She does everything right.
Okay, she is playing by the rules.
Therefore, she's completely excluded from the definition of an agent. She does not have to register.
Correct.
Since she doesn't have to register and she's technically operating outside the scope of agent regulations, can she just lie to those institutional investors about her company's financials to get their money? Is she exempt from securities fraud because she's exempt from registration?
I laugh every time someone tries this logic.
Come on, it's a loophole.
Firmly, aggressively, absolutely, no. There is no exemption from the Uniform Securities Act anti-fraud provisions. None whatsoever.
Universal anti-fraud blanket.
Exactly. The anti-fraud rules apply to all persons in all securities transactions, regardless of whether the person is registered, unregistered, excluded, or exempt.
No attachment.
It does not matter if you are selling a federal covered security to a billionaire hedge fund manager.
Yeah.
You cannot commit fraud. You cannot lie. You cannot omit material facts. And you cannot engage in deceptive practices. Period. If you are involved in a transaction that involves a security, the anti-fraud provisions blanket you completely.
The state will always catch you if you lie.
It will.
That is a perfect note to transition into our outro. We have covered a massive amount of highly testable material today.
We really have.
To help lock it in, we're going to do a rapid-fire recap. I'm going to hit you with a speed run of the absolute most testable takeaways from this entire deep dive.
Let's do it. Listeners, get your pens ready.
One. Form U4 update deadlines, normal life stuff, like an address change, you have 30 days. Statutory disqualifications, like a felony charge, you have 10 business days.
Spot on.
Two, the waiting room. Registration is generally effective 30 days at noon after applying, but the administrator has the power to accelerate it or delay it.
They hold the keys.
Three, the post-withdrawal window. The administrator can come after your withdrawn license for 1 year to issue a revocation or bar.
Four, the criminal window. The state attorney general, not the administrator, can prosecute you for up to 5 years, with penalties maxing out at $5,000 and 3 years in jail.
Five, the attempt. Affecting or attempting to affect makes you an agent. Even if you make zero sales on your cold calls, the attempt itself requires a license.
Six, the Fiona trap. The issuer-employee exclusion requires absolutely no commission or indirect remuneration. A year-end bonus tied to sales ruins the exclusion completely.
Seven, agent versus IRR. Agents act like pharmacists. They get commissions for executing trades and are held to suitability. IRs act like doctors. They get fees for giving advice and are held to a fiduciary standard.
That was an excellent synthesis. If you can internalize that rapid-fire list and understand the logic behind those rules, you have conquered the vast majority of the trick questions the exam writers will throw at you in this section.
As we wrap up, I want to hand it over to you for a final provocative thought.
Mm.
What is the one thing the listeners should mull over as they close their books today?
We've spent this entire time dissecting dense legal rules and exclusions, but the entire regulatory system is really built on a single, incredibly simple premise. Follow the money.
Follow the money.
As the financial industry evolves, the lines between giving advice, the IAR, and selling a product, the agent, are getting blurrier in the real world.
Yeah.
Broker-dealers offer wrap accounts, robo-advisors offer hybrid models, and everyone is trying to capture more of the client's wallet.
It's all blending together.
It is, but on the Series 65 exam, those lines are a brick wall. When you look at your own financial life, or when you read a convoluted test question about Broker Bob or Founder Fiona, ask yourself one foundational question.
What's the question?
Is the person I'm talking to getting paid for the idea or getting paid for the execution? Following the compensation will almost always lead you to the correct regulatory jurisdiction. Knowing the difference isn't just good for passing the Series 65, it's good for your own wallet. And it is the absolute key to understanding how Wall Street really works.
Get paid for the idea or get paid for the execution. Follow the money. Listen, you have the knowledge, you know the traps, and you are going to absolutely crush this exam. Keep grinding, keep spotting those tripwires, and we will see you on the next deep dive.